Welcome to Legal Talk with attorney Kevin Flesch of Flesch and Beck Law. Auto accidents, DUIs, slip and falls, each one can change your life. But the trial-tested, trial-ready attorneys at Flesch and Beck Law relieve your legal burden. Whether you need to heal from an injury or protect your future in a criminal matter, the legal team at Flesch and Beck Law is prepared to defend your rights. Now, here's Legal Talk with your host, Scott Whatley, and attorney Kevin Flesch.
Welcome to Legal Talk. My name is Scott Whatley, and we thank you for being with us. Our show each week is brought to you by the law firm of Flesch and Beck Law. Their number, 303-806-8886. Kevin Flesch joins us in studio today. Kevin, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks.
Man, I tell you, I think the legal world, because every time we do these shows, and we've been doing them for many, many years now, and, you know, I talk to people, they're like, man, you guys always go over some stuff that's just really cool and break it down, because we've all watched the court shows and police shows on TV, and which is probably mostly not what real life is.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it is, but most of the time it's not. Yeah, absolutely right.
And so, you know, I'm so glad, because, man, we provide hopefully some education for people and just to know what to do when they get into certain situations. And you said recently on the show, you know, boy, there's so many things that when you end up in a legal battle, there were probably things that were available to you you did not do, and that's why you're in a legal mess. And our topic today is something that is 100% of the time avoidable.
100% preventable. Completely.
And that's DUI.
Yes. It's failure to plan.
But it happens.
It's amazing how often it happens
so much.
With the amount of resources that we have in our community in the Front Range to be able to get home from wherever you're at, because normally you're going home, after being in, after consuming alcohol, generally speaking, or marijuana, and getting behind the wheel. I mean, it's just one of those things where I'm amazed by the amount of cases we still have with all of the resources that people have to make better decisions. Because it's, like you said, it's completely preventable. And that's the conversation I have the majority of the time with people that get themselves into this situation with what was going on. And it's always interesting because many times it's a failure to plan. But sometimes it's something did happen. You know, I got jumped in a bar, and I didn't think that I needed to be there or I needed to stay there. It was an emergency situation, so I got in my car and I drove. You know, why didn't you just drive a block, get out of your car, and call the police? You know, I mean, it's stuff like that that people don't really think about. And obviously, you're intoxicated, so you're not making the best decisions anyway. But this show is not about, you know, oh, it's okay to drink and drive.
Yeah,
it's not.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there you can legally drink and drive. I mean, I make that argument all the time with individuals who have two drinks and they're below, you know, the 0.05 level, because it does happen. I have a number of cases a year where we get the blood results back and they're below the legal limit. And then the DA, you know, a lot of times young DAs in particular will say, well, they were still acting like they were under the influence. Yeah, but the standard for alcohol is 0.05. And so if they're below that, they're actually legally driving.
Right.
And that's, you know, but most people don't know what that limit is. I mean, it's a drink and a half in a couple of hours. It's not very much, you know, before you're driving illegally. And so, again, it's just one of those situations where you've got to plan those things out. And the smart people, the people that have a plan, never see me about this issue. A lot of times, though, what's going on with DUIs is there's lots of things going on in a person's life, and it's just an indicator of their lives being out of control.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so those sorts of scenarios, then my job is a little different, because now I'm trying to not only help people through the criminal process, making sure that they don't have to spend any time in jail, but then helping them with their lives to figure out empathetically, why is this happening? Why is alcohol such an important part of your life? How do we help you with that so that this doesn't happen again? And then you become a better person, because you're not relying on some sort of substance to balance out the issues that you're having.
Right.
And those sorts of conversations, as I've grown in my practice, those conversations are actually really fun conversations for people who are willing to admit that they have a problem. Those conversations are really good conversations to have, because we can really help people in the sense of giving them suggestions about what they need to do that long term will help them, so that they don't have any more issues in their lives.
Sure.
And they're better planners.
And people need to understand, DUI is on your record forever.
Ever.
We talked about this.
Yeah.
No matter what ages.
Nope, doesn't matter. So that's the interesting thing. There was a perception, a misperception years ago that because DMV, basically your history fell off after about 7 years whenever you had any sort of things in on your driving history in the way of tickets and also alcohol-related offenses, that those, once they dropped off, they were gone. But that's not what the statute says anymore. It's a lifetime history, and there's about 36 states in the union now that sort of communicate with each other. So if you have an alcohol-related offense in another state, even 40 years ago, it's going to come up, and it's going to affect what happens with a sentence in this state now, mm-hmm. relating to any sort of alcohol-related offense or any DUID sort of situation. So those things don't go away. So they're always important to deal with, even if it's a first offense. You want to get a lawyer and you want to deal with it, even if you think that it's a rather simple matter to resolve.
Sure.
You're going to want to get counsel, because there's many times where there's some tech. There's the interesting thing about DUI defense is there's a lot of technical mm-hmm. things that come up that unless you're doing it on a regular basis, you're going to miss some of those things that people don't really realize until they've missed them.
Yeah.
And you know, there's motions issues. There's procedural things that the police need to do. There's things that come up, you know. A good example is on a ready report, for example. So we always see the state patrol saying, you know, see a drunk driver, report it sort of thing. Normally those are anonymous reports. And so the anonymous report isn't bad. It helps us make sure that we get anybody that is under the influence off the roads, because normally the state patrol will try to find them mm-hmm. and then watch them. But if the person is then driving in front of the state patrol and they pull them over for something when they didn't do any bad driving, for example, then maybe a case that you can get thrown out because there's no reasonable suspicion at the point in which the state patrol pulls them over, because an anonymous tip isn't necessarily a credible one, because you don't get to, in the criminal process, you don't get to cross-examine that person because you don't know who it is. And constitutionally, those cases are much more easily defended.
Right.
But normally what the state patrol does is they follow you long enough that you do something wrong in the way of a legal issue with driving, and then they pull you over for that. So,
sure.
But I've had situations where a person is pumping gas at a gas station. They had a ready report at a bar that they were drunk, and the officer starts talking to them. Well, there's no reasonable suspicion at that point because my client wasn't driving. They weren't even behind the wheel. And, mm-hmm. You know, that's a case where clearly they're under the influence, and clearly they shouldn't have been driving, but it's not a legal matter at that point because they don't have reasonable suspicion to be in contact with them, and those are the cases that we get dismissed. Mm-hmm. But if you don't do it on a regular basis, you wouldn't understand that.
Absolutely.
And so those are the sorts of things that we help people with, understanding what exactly is in the discovery. That's the evidence that the prosecution has against the people, and diagnosing what it is that we think we can do to help people. And I'm not trying to get people out of what was done. What I'm trying to do is make sure
you still have rights.
Yep.
No matter what you've done, pretty much in the legal world, you still have rights.
Exactly. I mean, our Constitution was put together for a reason, to make sure that the one person that is not guilty of any crime is protected, and that the process is fair. And mm-hmm. so that's really what we're looking at, to make sure that the process is working correctly. Because we don't want the process to get out of hand and be, you know, you want to have faith in our criminal justice
sure.
system. And I have faith in it. I mean, I would say it's the best system in the world, and I think that at the end of the day, the jurors making decisions about guilt or innocence relating to a crime, and those individuals are in the community, are the best arbiters of what's right or wrong.
Right.
And so the idea of these cases is to make sure that you have somebody on your side advocating for you, and we're also helping you get better, because a lot of times that's what we're talking about in
right.
these cases, rehabilitation, and not really looking at the punitive sanctions of it. And the nice thing about getting us on early in the process is you can start a lot of these things that you would have to do on probation anyway, and then you shorten your time period on probation potentially, and that way you save yourself money relating to the process itself too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, you're listening to Legal Talk. Attorney Kevin Flesh is with us. All right. Now, to understand a DUI, first of all, there's several different initials for
yes.
different charges. There's DUI, driving under the influence, DWI, And then OWI.
Yep.
So kind of explain the differences there.
Yeah. So in Colorado, the vernacular here, for the most part, is the DUI and the DWAI. So the driving under the influence means that you're substantially incapable of driving a motor vehicle after consuming, generally speaking, it's alcohol, but it can be drugs too. And it can be prescription drugs. And that would be a DUID, where you're dealing with drugs versus alcohol. So the idea from the standpoint of the statute is that's sort of the high watermark of the worst case scenario that you have relating to an alcohol related offense when you haven't had an accident and hurt someone. So if you just have your regular sort of traffic stop, you're over the limit, and the limit for the DUI is 0.08 blood alcohol levels. So that's, you can take a breath or a blood test. Those are the chemical tests that you would take in Colorado relating to the determination of your alcohol content in your blood. The idea with that is that there's been enough study relating to the ingestion of alcohol and how it affects you that if you're at that level or higher, the legislature has determined that that by itself is an indicator that you're impaired, substantially impaired to drive a motor vehicle. So that's the idea. Now, the lesser included of these crimes is the DWAI, and it's driving while ability impaired to the slightest degree is essentially what the DWAI stands for. And the idea is that that level is between 0.05 and 0.08 BAC.
Okay.
So it's a lower alcohol content in your blood, but it's still enough that they say that you're impaired to the slightest degree. So that's a really low standard. I mean, if you think about it.
It doesn't take much.
It doesn't take much at all. Right. And the idea, you know, there's sometimes that we still haven't gotten to the point where if you're sleepy, that you could be charged with a DWAI. But I every once in a while have an argument from a district attorney that, you know, that affects your ability to drive and you could be charged, but you can't be in Colorado. The only way that you can be charged is if you've ingested some sort of alcohol or drug. And the same thing is true with the DWAI, is it can be a drug-related offense as well.
Okay.
But generally speaking, relating to the alcohol, it's a very low standard. And that's what's a lot of times happens when you, let's say you have a blood alcohol level of 0.14, and but there's circumstances surrounding the stop that are an issue, and the district attorney has some concerns about me being able to argue to have the case dismissed. Maybe they'll offer a DWAI, a lesser included traffic matter, shorter periods of probation, less community service, those sorts of things to resolve the case. And that's where we see a lot of those sorts of resolutions of the cases taken care of. The same thing can be true for drugs. Marijuana is interesting because we don't have a specific level that the legislature has said that you reach and then you're impaired because there hasn't been enough study relating to it. There's sort of this 5 nanogram standard that if you're below it, you're probably not impaired. If you're above it, you are. But that has not been determined yet. It's something that the DAs try to use, but the legislature hasn't sort of given us that bright line test like they have in the alcohol-related offenses.
Right. So since that the marijuana whole thing started in Colorado, have you seen a rise?
Yeah, sure have. Okay. Because what has happened is we've had a population of people that have moved here that are chronic smokers. They're smoking every day. And what happens is, unlike alcohol, you shed off the alcohol in your bloodstream pretty quickly. The THC that you ingest relating to using marijuana stays in the fatty cells of your blood, or in your body. And so when you have a blood test taken, that THC is in your body for a long time, up to 30 days.
Oh, wow.
And so you may be, you know, I have lots of folks that will not smoke on a particular day or not ingest THC on a particular day, but they'll still have high THC levels because they have the last week or so. And so even though, and that's where it's really important to do the voluntary roadside maneuvers a lot of times, because those voluntary roadside maneuvers will show that physically you don't have an issue but your blood suggests that you're still impaired. And so if you're in a situation where you do smoke on a regular basis and you're still driving, you know, almost every day if you were pulled over and they have reasonable suspicion to believe you're impaired, you will want to go through those roadsides to show that you're still physically able to drive a vehicle. Because if you don't, then they're going to get this blood work back that shows you were high on THC when you weren't. Mm-hmm. And those are cases that people get themselves into a lot of trouble. And that's really the trouble with people consuming THC on a regular basis, is I would say the majority of the time they're probably driving under the influence based upon their blood. And so that's, we're waiting for more studies relating to that. And those cases are really, what we normally do to really defend those cases is there's some experts in the state now that are testifying about that specific issue and the fact that even though you have these high levels, you may not be impaired based upon other evidence.
Okay.
And so those are the things where people really need to think about if they get pulled over and they're asked to do these things. Because generally speaking, relating to an alcohol-related offense, I would advise people to never do the voluntary roadside maneuvers, because you don't need to provide the police officer and in turn the district attorney more evidence of your impairment.
Yeah.
You just don't want to do that. But in the event that you don't believe you are impaired relating to marijuana, for example, but you know that your THC levels are going to be high because you're smoking or ingesting THC through edibles or whatever on a regular basis, you're going to want to do those roadsides because it may be exculpatory. It may be evidence that you can use at trial to say, look, I did the follow the line test fine. I didn't have any nystagmus in my eyes. The nystagmus
are
is
those
the,
recorded?
They are. They're all on body cameras now.
Okay. All right.
Which, that's another topic that we should talk about, is that in the last two years, most of the police forces have now gotten body cameras for all of their officers.
Okay.
And that body camera footage is really beneficial, generally speaking, for the defense. What it does is it clarifies exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Before, we would rely on the reports from the officers, and the reports were almost always embellished about what took place. Now we get to see those roadsides. And in the case of individuals who are allegedly under the influence of marijuana,
right,
they can be really helpful when you're not, when you're able to do these things. Because generally speaking, the officers are trained to almost always say that you've not done the voluntary roadside maneuvers as a sober person would do. Even if, I mean, I very rarely see it where they don't make that statement. So, but to actually see it in person is really beneficial, especially for jurors to see, well, he looks pretty good. He's not swaying. He's not slurring his words, even though the officer said he was. You know, there may be red, bloodshot, watery eyes, but that there's lots of reasons for
right.
that. Nystagmus is a big deal when it comes to marijuana, because you shouldn't have any nystagmus. That's where they do the test with the eyes, where you have the involuntary jittering of the eyes on the outer portion of the eye. And that normally indicates the ingestion of alcohol, or it could be a closed head injury. I mean, there are reasons that you have nystagmus that aren't related to being impaired. And so those are all things that we need to consider when talking to a person and talking with them about what took place during that period of time. Because let's say if somebody got into an accident and did have a head injury, well, when the officer does the nystagmus test, it could very well be related to that head injury and not related to an alcohol-related offense.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
Stuff we need to think about.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, I said a DUI is always on your record. All these other initials, too?
Yep.
They
Any,
stay forever?
Forever.
Okay.
Any alcohol-related offense is always on your record for the for your remainder of your life.
Right. And when it comes to the defense of this, I mean, there are several points, you know, just wanted to bring out today that for people to understand is, you want to talk about a charge that's got some important time structures to it. There are some things people have to understand. I mean, you've got certain
DMV.
Days to do different things. So explain that.
Exactly. So relating to the DMV. So you have, you've been pulled over. You do a breath test. The breath test comes back above the legal limit, above 0.08. The officer is going to take your driver's license. They're going to give you what's called an express consent affidavit. And in that express consent affidavit, they'll have you sign specifically at the bottom, and it'll have an advisement to you that that is your license once they've taken your physical driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be your license, your driver's license, for 7 days. It's generally a yellow piece of paper, and the advisement says that you have the right to request a hearing with the Department of Motor Vehicles within 7 days of being arrested. If you don't make that request within that 7-day period of time, you lose your right to a hearing. And you want to have a hearing with DMV. A lot of people get confused about the fact that when they are arrested for a DUI, there's two things that happen. One is the criminal process. That's related to your liberty and what you may have to do with the county court wherever this happened. That's the first process, and you'll have a summons where you have to appear in court.
Okay.
The second part of what takes place will be this serving of the express consent affidavit, which basically says that while driving in Colorado, you agree that if the officer has probable cause to ask you to do a test, a chemical test, that you've done a chemical test, the result of that, and it's always a breath test that this happens, the result of the breath test is over the legal limit, and you now have had your license taken from you, and you have 7 days to request this hearing. You want to request, in my opinion, you want to request that the officer be present, because there's a certain period, there's 20-25% of the time the officers don't show up for these hearings. And if they don't show up when you've requested them to show up, then you get your driver privilege back. So, and the driving privilege issue is a separate issue from the county court issue. County court has no control over what happens with your driver's license, only DMV. Your privilege to drive is controlled by DMV, not the county court. Now, the county court may affect your ability to drive based upon the amount of points that you're either convicted of or you agree to through a plea bargain. You can only get 11 points in any rolling calendar year. Anything above 11 points, you lose your privilege to drive based upon points.
Gotcha.
You also lose it on based upon an alcohol-related offense. So this particular instance we're talking about specifically, the night of, you do the breath test, it's above the legal limit, they take your driver's license. The other thing that's confusing is if you'd opt not for a breath test, but for a blood test. And that blood test right now is taking anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks to get those results back.
Oh, wow.
So you'll be arrested. You've decided to take the blood test. They've done the blood. There's two vials of blood that they send off to the lab. They keep one for defense, so we get it retested. The other blood they'll actually analyze and get a result. So the night of your arrest, in that case, you'll only get the summons. You'll still have your driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have your driver's license because on the night of the arrest, they don't know what your blood alcohol level was. And so you'll keep that driver's license, and you've got a perfectly good driving history until you get notice from DMV that the results have come back and the results are above the legal limit. Then you again have an obligation very quickly to make a request for that DMV hearing. Otherwise, you lose it. So a lot of people get confused about that. They're like, well, I still have my driver's license, and I'm waiting for the blood results. The other thing that they get upset about is the fact that, generally speaking, you show up for your first appearance for your criminal case in the county court. They don't have the blood results back yet, so you have to continue it out. And a lot of folks, a lot of folks want to get these things done quickly. So they're like, well, I'll just plead to something. Well, you don't want to, because you don't know what those blood results are going to be yet.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that people don't realize is that if it's just a purely a marijuana issue, there's no regulations about your driver's license and marijuana right now in Colorado. So if you do a blood test and it comes back that your amount of THC in your system were 17 nanograms, for example, which is really high. But the legislature, because there isn't a specific bright line, oh, if you're above this number, you're impaired, You have no nothing happens to your driver's license while the process is moving forward. Now, if you get convicted of a 12-point DUI because of marijuana down the road, that will affect your ability to drive based upon points. But it won't be until you have that county court matter resolved.
Right. Now, that number of days, 7 days, does that start from the date of the ticket, the date you get out of
Yeah, it starts the date of the arrest.
Okay.
So if you're in custody, because I have this happen a lot, people may be sitting in jail for 2 or 3 days. Let's say if you get arrested on Friday night, you have two priors, so they've been unwilling to give you a bond until Monday morning. You've lost 3 days. So you've got to get that done.
Now you got 4 days.
Yep. Okay. So you want to make that request. You can do it online now, which is great. So you have the ability to do it virtually, but you want to get it done right away, even if you were in custody. They do have a process that, let's say you were in custody for 10 days and you've missed your window, They do have a process that you can explain that to DMV and say the reason that I didn't make the request is because I was in custody the whole time,
right?
And it's a few days after that deadline. They will normally allow you to have a hearing, and they'll normally waive that 7-day requirement. But it's a very small percentage of the folks that fall into that category. So if you're out of custody, if you're out in the community, you need to get it done within that 7 days of being arrested.
Gotcha. Okay. Yep. And, I mean, we always see on TV, somebody gets arrested and go, well, I'll get my phone call. Is that really? So I guess what is the step for the person? They get arrested. They go to jail. Do they get a loved one? They try to get in touch with a loved one to call you? I mean, what? How do they get a hold of you then?
The officers will generally give you the ability to make a phone call.
Okay.
But it comes down to how you've reacted to that officer,
yeah,
and how gracious they want to be about it. I mean, there's no constitutional rule that says, you know, within the time period of being arrested that you immediately get to have a phone call. Most of the time they do it because it's good for them to do it, and you're going to be out within 24 hours anyway, so mm-hmm. they'll give you the opportunity to, while you, because most of us don't anymore know the phone numbers that we need
exactly.
to call.
Yeah.
So they'll normally let you, while you're sitting in booking, while you're waiting, because there's a 20-minute deprivation period in which you have to not be consuming anything and make sure that your mouth is all clear before you do a breath test.
Okay.
It'll be normally during that time period that the officer will allow you to make a phone call to tell somebody, hey, I'm in jail. I may call you later after I get out. Can you come and get me? That sort of thing.
Gotcha.
So what a lot of people have trouble with is that they say, well, I wasn't Mirandized when I was pulled over. And you're not entitled to a Miranda warning before, because normally what happens is they'll ask you a bunch of questions, and the voluntary roadside maneuvers, you're not under arrest. They're voluntary.
Gotcha.
And so Miranda, what we think of Miranda, Miranda's essentially interrogation of you when you're in custody. You're not in custody when you do those voluntary roadside maneuvers. So all of those statements that you make are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that I tell people is say as little as possible.
Yeah. Don't Which unfortunately jabber on. Is usually not what goes along with being intoxicated.
Exactly.
Right?
That's exactly right.
And a first-time DUI, and this is, we can say this without an accident. Okay,
yes.
Just you got pulled over. Mm-hmm. You're tapping on the door $10,000,
yes.
Right?
It's a very expensive Uber ride.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, it's a lot. And that's the trouble, is that the system is set up that there's lots of things you'll have to do to rehabilitate yourself, and it all costs money.
Yeah.
So the best thing to do is always have a plan if you intend to be out drinking and have your vehicle. So figure something else out, because it's just so much easier.
Absolutely.
And then you don't have to deal with me,
which,
I mean, I like seeing people, but
sure.
I'd rather not see them dealing with these
Absolutely.
Issues.
Absolutely. Kevin, great information. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's Kevin Flesh, Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886. You've been listening to Legal Talk for Kevin Flesh. My name is Scott Watley. Thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Call now for a free consultation with Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886, 303-806-8886, or visit fleshlawfirm.com. That's FLESCH, fleshlawfirm.com. A proven team dedicated to your legal needs.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
With rates on the rise, how do you get the best rate? Take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Did you know that when you get cash out, or your FICO score is below a 740, or you're financing a condo versus a single-family home, it will cost you more in rate and fees? Many lenders are charging more. Stop paying it. At Affordable Interest Mortgage, we have lenders that don't charge. Trying to purchase a second home, or is your loan amount considered a high balance or jumbo? There they go again, charging you more. Take AIM, 720-895-0500. Let us show you a loan that doesn't charge more. Seeing a low rate but not reading the small print, only to realize all the extra costs and fees? Again, stop. Call 720-895-0500. Affordable Interest Mortgage. Quit paying fees and closing costs that are unnecessary. Get a low rate without all the extra cost. Let us show you how to save thousands. Call 720-895-0500 now. Affordable Interest Mortgage. 720-895-0500. Serving Coloradans for over 20 years. NMLS 298191, regulated by DORA.
This is KLZ 560, your home station.
This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Protect Your Legacy. My name is Scott Watley, and again, we thank you so much for being with us. Our show is brought to you by Blake Harris Law, and it's always good to have attorney Blake Harris with us. Blake, thanks for being with us today on Protect Your Legacy.
Scott, thanks so much for having me back on the show.
You bet, you bet. And I tell you what, never know when people get out of the car, so I'm going to tell you, remember this number. Blake has made it very easy, 833-ASK-BLAKE, and we will give that out several times throughout the show. Well, a little bit different tone to this week's show, and I just want to be very transparent with our listening audience. Saturday, April 16th, a little before 1 o'clock, I lost my father in Dallas, Texas. And we've been very, very close our entire lives, and he was 88 years old. And Blake, as we were discussing here a little bit before we came on air today, all the things that we talk about every week on this show certainly came into focus for me going through this with my father, and so thankful he had several of the things that we've talked about in place, which made things, when I say a little bit easier just from that standpoint, but does take some of the load off your mind a little bit when you're dealing with so many things and emotions. But there were a few things he didn't, but didn't want to focus on that today. I just want to focus on, you know, the importance, Blake, of what you sit across the table from or a Zoom call with people and work through people, because I'm telling you, you do a great work in helping people about this end of life. And you've said it many times, and I even have written in some of my notes, at one point you said something like you're 10 times more likely to become incapacitated next year than pass away. And I'm telling you, when you're there with a loved one and the incapacitation hits, and it may be 30 minutes after you just had a good conversation, once that incapacity hits, all the regret in the world for not having these documents in place and the lack of planning will not help you. So I'm going to let you just kind of take it from there, and then we'll just work into some of these documents that are so important.
Sure. Well, Scott, first of all, my sincere condolences on the passing of your father. I hope your family's taking some time to heal during this difficult time.
Thank you, sir.
It's interesting that I do get a handful of clients who are just very planning-oriented, and they contact me because they know about estate planning and they want to take care of the important things. And then I get a lot of people who they're in a position similar to you. They have a loved one who passes away, and then all of a sudden that is their motivation. That is their wake-up call to get their estate planning in place. It is a very difficult time for all of us when this happens, but being prepared, having the proper documents in place, can certainly make things easier on your family. And that's what we're all here to do. That's what we're all here to do anyways, make things as easy as possible on our family, especially during an otherwise difficult time. So let's talk a little bit about what we can do to plan for our potential incapacity or passing away.
Okay.
And incapacity, as I've said before, much more likely to happen in the next year than you are to become incapacitated, than you are to pass away. And the way to plan for potential incapacity is to have a complete set of financial and medical power of attorney documents. I'm going to walk us through the primary documents which everyone should have in place. The first one, in my opinion, the most important estate planning document that anyone can have in place is a financial power of attorney. A financial power of attorney allows the individual you have selected to make a financial decision on your behalf if you become incapacitated. If you don't have a financial power of attorney, your family will need to go through a court-supervised conservatorship process, which can be a very expensive and very time-consuming process. And serve as conservator, these types of processes often run $10,000 or $20,000 or more. So there's no really better value in the estate planning world than having a financial power of attorney in place. The next three documents that I'm going to discuss for planning for your incapacity relate to your medical needs. The first one would be a medical power of attorney. Now, this is in the situation that you've lost capacity. You can no longer communicate your wishes, that your medical power of attorney steps in to make a decision on your behalf. In the absence of a medical power of attorney, your family members may need to go through a court-supervised guardianship proceeding. Again, this can cost $10,000, $20,000 or more, depending on whether there's any conflicts within the family and determining who should serve as the medical power of attorney. The other two documents relating to your health care to plan for your incapacity are a HIPAA authorization. HIPAA is a federal law which protects the privacy of your health care. And in the event that you become incapacitated, you want your agents to be able to access that protected health care information so that they can share it with the doctors and make informed medical decisions. And then finally is an advanced health care directive, or also known as a living will, or Colorado uses the term declaration as to medical or surgical treatment. And this is where you state that you want to be treated in a certain manner, you're comfortable with certain medications in the event that you lose capacity and somebody else has to make medical decisions for you. It also has the outlines for your wishes in the unfortunate event that you're in a permanent vegetative state. In most circumstances, people don't want to be kept indefinitely on a life support or a feeding tube. It allows family members to go ahead and end life peacefully, not drag it on unnecessarily. Any more than necessary. So just to recap, a complete set of incapacity documents includes a financial power of attorney, a medical power of attorney, a HIPAA authorization, and a living will or advanced health care directive.
Absolutely. And, you know, back up just a little bit when you bring up the financial power of attorney, I think many people, and of course I would have myself had I not been doing these shows with you, but many people I've even talked to have no idea how quickly the financial institutions are notified of death, and it does not matter what your last name is, if it matches the deceased or not. If you are not on that account or have those proper documents, you're not touching that money.
Yes, this is true. People assume, oh, this is my spouse, I've been married to them for a long period of time, I'll be able to go in and just manage their affairs. Or your husband has all of the money in his account and been the one taking care of the finances for a long time. The wife, the surviving spouse, or the children could get caught in a little bit of a pickle where you need funds to manage your day-to-day life and you're not able to access them. And then you end up having to go through that expensive and time-consuming guardianship or conservatorship proceeding. So a little bit of planning or an ounce prevention can be worth more than a pound of the cure, and this is certainly true when it comes to estate planning. Absolutely. So beyond the incapacity documents comes planning for your passing away, planning for what happens to your property in the event that you do pass away or when you do pass away. And there's two main documents needed for planning for your death, planning for your passing. The first one is a last will and testament. The last will and testament allows you to do a couple of things. It allows you to select who receives your property when you pass away, and it allows you to nominate a guardian for any minor children. So if you have any children who are under the age of 18 or any children who are disabled, it allows you to select who's going to step in as the legal parent for them. However, a will is a ticket to the probate court. Common misconception that a will is going to avoid probate. This is not true. A will is a ticket to the probate court. And if you want to keep your property out of probate, and in most circumstances people do want to keep their property out of an expensive and time-consuming government process, you should create what's called a revocable living trust. So with a revocable living trust, you're still going to have a will, a last will and testament. And the last will and testament is going to simply say any property that you still own at your passing pours into your trust. It's called a pour-over, a spillover will. Now, the trust, a revocable living trust, and allows you to keep full control over your property now while you're alive, healthy, and able to make your own financial decisions. With a trust, kind of like a power of attorney, in the event that you become incapacitated, there's another individual set out who can step in and take care of any financial decisions. The successor trustee can manage the trust during any period of your incapacity, and during any time that you're incapacitated, that successor trustee can distribute funds from the trust for your benefit. Then once you pass away, the money will, number one, stay out of probate. any assets that are properly put into the trust will avoid probate, but also the trust can give a protected inheritance to your beneficiary. And a protected inheritance can mean a few different things. Number one, it can protect minor beneficiaries, children, from spending through their funds too quickly. I've never met anyone who received a large inheritance at 18 or 21 and looked back and said that was good for them. Generally, what I recommend is clients have an independent trustee, another family member or friend or professional trust company making the decisions as to when distributions are made up until a child reaches a certain age, typically about age 30. After the age of 30, what we do usually is allow the beneficiary, the child, to appoint their trustee. They get to determine who's the one managing their trust. Once it gets to that point that they're old enough to appoint their trustee, they're going to have more liberal access to the money. They'll be able to get money out of the trust pretty much any time that they want it. And if their trustee is not complying, well, they can simply fire their trustee and go appoint a new trustee in their place. So they're going to be able to access and enjoy the money after once they reach a certain age, age 25, age 30, age 35, whatever you, the client, decide. Now, for the children, the beneficiaries, we do give them lifetime protection from outside parties. So it's temporary protection from themselves until they're old enough to manage their own financial affairs. And then once they are old enough to manage their own financial affairs, we still give them protection from outside parties. What does that mean? If a beneficiary is sued, if a beneficiary has too much student debt or too much or a medical illness and too much medical debt, or if you have a child who goes through a divorce, instead of that child losing half of their inheritance in the divorce, their inheritance remains a protected remains protected, and the trust doesn't allow anybody other than your children or the beneficiaries you have selected to enjoy the property that you leave behind. Okay. Now, with a trust, there's also a very important overlooked issue that's funding the trust. And we've talked a little bit about funding before, but we'll go through that real quick. When you create a trust, it's not enough just to sign the trust and assume everything is going to be okay. You also have to transfer property into the trust. So when you're discussing setting up an estate plan with your attorney, make sure you ask them about, is funding included? What is the funding? What do I need to do to make sure that the trust is properly funded? And most everyone has four main types of assets. Number one is real estate. If you own a primary home, the real estate can be transferred into the trust by a deed. You can use a quitclaim deed or a beneficiary deed. We just want to see the title transferred into the trust at the immediately or at the passing of the client. If you own additional real estate other than your primary home, such as a rental property, generally what I would recommend is that you put that property into an LLC so that you're protected from the property. That way, if a tenant slips and falls and hurts themselves, they don't come back after you personally. And then that LLC should be placed into the trust. So real estate can either go directly into the trust or under an LLC and then into the trust. The next type of assets would be liquid cash accounts, stock accounts, investment accounts, any financial accounts. So any type of financial account, you can retitle into the name of the trust, or you can simply update the beneficiary designation, the TOD, the transfer on debt designation, and transfer that into the trust. Then the third type of asset people have is their tangible personal property, their clothing, their jewelry, their furniture. All of these assets can be transferred into the trust through a simple blanket assignment which says any tangible property that I have now or later acquire, I'm transferring into my trust. And under this arrangement, any tangible personal property will not need to go through the probate process.
All right, now, quick question. Some people may think, okay, my primary housing, if I put that into a trust, does that keep me from, like, what if I want to sell that house in 2 years? Does that present a lot of complications getting it out of that trust to sell it? How does that work?
Not at all. It's a revocable living trust. The client, in almost all circumstances, will serve as the trustee of their own trust. They're going to have the power to buy or sell property on behalf of the trust. They can add more property to the trust or take it out of the trust at any time. So there's plenty of flexibility built into your revocable living trust. It doesn't prevent that at all. What I was thinking we could take a few more minutes to do, time permitting, is talk about some of the most common estate planning mistakes.
Absolutely, yes, sir.
That you may have encountered, or that I've encountered as well. The first biggest mistake is simply putting it off. Many people, I think, put off estate planning because they fear it's going to be a daunting task, or they're just afraid to acknowledge the fact that at some point they are going to pass away. But if you're an adult and you've got adult money, you need to be an adult and really recognize that your time on this earth is limited, and you need to do what you can to make your family's future as wonderful as possible, even when you're not here. You've done all you can to make it as wonderful as possible while you're here. Waking up to the reality that your family is going to have to survive without you is simply the mature and right thing to do. But also, I think people fear it's going to be a daunting and complicated task. However, when you work with an estate planning law firm, we're going to guide you through the process of setting up an estate plan and handhold you throughout the process so that you don't get confused, you understand what you're signing, you understand the documents that are being prepared for you, you understand the benefits of everything that's being created for you. It's actually, the process to create an estate plan is now, I think, probably easier than it's ever been before. For most of our clients, we'll start out with either a Zoom or a phone call. After that, we'll be able to give our recommendations as to what should be included in your estate plan. We then give a flat fee price quote so clients know exactly what they're getting into. They're not surprised by hourly billing for additional questions or changes or revisions that are made during the preparation of the documents. Once the clients have hired us and we have the information we need to prepare the documents, it only takes about 3 weeks to get the estate plan all set up. And then when it comes time to actually execute the documents, the clients are either welcome to come into our office. We have a beautiful office space in downtown Denver, next to Union Station, with free parking next door, or we can mail you the documents, and you can simply hire a notary to come to your home or meet with the notary on your own. So if you'd like, you give us a call. We'll start the process over the phone. We'll send you an electronic copy of the documents to review and approve online. We'll then mail you the documents. You hire a notary, and you can complete the entire estate planning process without leaving your home, and we're there to guide you through the entire process. It's all done on a flat fee so that you can walk away with the utmost confidence that you got an estate, a comprehensive estate plan, and you knew exactly what you were getting into when you started the process.
Absolutely. Once again, if you're just getting in the car or turning on the radio, you're listening to attorney Blake Harris from Blake Harris Law. The number 833-ASK-BLAKE. Highly recommend for you to check out his website. Several reasons. I want you to take a minute and just look at all of the 5-star reviews, and I'm telling you, if 10 stars was the guidelines there, they would all be 10s. But if you just read each story, of each personal story of folks that have willingly gone on, and Blake, you know, a lot of people don't even take the time to do that because they go, hey, you know what, the guy took care of me, whatever, I'm not going to take time to sit and write a review. But man, it just shows how important and the personal care and touch that you have with your clients that they would take the time then to go on and tell others, hey, Blake Harris Law is the place to be of help to you.
Yes, we are lucky that lots of clients have written many glowing reviews. Just type Blake Harris Law reviews into Google, and it'll pop right up. I believe we have over 70 Google reviews, and I believe every single one to 5 out of 5 stars. So go online. You can read some of the glowing reviews. Visit our website, BlakeHarrisLaw.com, or you can give us a call, 833-ASK-BLAKE. And if you've already created an estate plan, but it's been some time or there's been some changes in your family situation, avoid what I see as the second biggest mistake, and that's not updating your estate plan. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I've got children who come into our office and say, well, my father created this estate plan 25 years before he's passing. He's left a lot of money to an ex-wife that he is no longer in contact, hasn't put any of his new assets into the trust. So if you have an estate plan and you haven't looked at it or reviewed it in a while, I certainly recommend taking the time to review it. My firm is certainly able to help with reviewing estate planning documents as well. And then the third biggest mistake is not working with a professional. Nowadays, there's a variety of online and do-it-yourself resources for just about anything, including creating an estate plan. And while it is legal to create an estate plan on your own, I will tell you that I've spoken with far too many families that have had to spend thousands or tens of thousands of dollars cleaning up a mess which they could have easily avoided had they just sought the proper guidance. when it comes to creating an estate plan, it's well worth the time and energy to meet with a professional who creates and administers estate plans every single day.
Absolutely. And, you know, Blake, I think a lot of times people think, too, hey, my financial situation is just simple. I don't need an estate plan. And I think I'm safe in saying that there's nothing simple when it comes to financials after a loved one passes away. I mean, you need things in writing and a plan, don't you?
Yes. I mean, I've also come across a situation where many times where, oh, mom said this or dad said this. Here's my advice. Don't say anything to your children about your estate plan. Do something about it. Put your wishes in writing. Mm-hmm. And then you don't necessarily need to tell them. Tell whoever's going to be the trustee or the personal representative about the plan you've created and the documents where to find them. But if you end up promising the beach, promising the mountain condo to one of your children, and then you later decide to share that condo among all three of your children, well, there's going to be a little bit of an issue because you've got a child now who has an expectation of receiving the property, and they're not going to be real happy about it. And then this is where unhappy beneficiaries will contest an estate. And this is going to be the most expensive thing that can happen to a family. And it's devastating both in terms of and financially, but it can also cause a lot of bad will and bad emotions among the children. So put together an estate plan with clear instructions, but don't go and tell the beneficiaries what all they're receiving. They can find out when the time comes.
Sure. And Blake, sometimes do you find when you mention the words estate plan or the words trust to people, sometimes they say, hey, that's for the wealthy. That's not for me.
So, yes, it's a very common question I get is, how much money do I need to have a trust? And it's kind of not the right question. The question is, when do I need a trust? And, yes, the level of assets is a certain factor to consider. But I will tell you, I had a couple in my office a little while back, married couple. They were worth about $9 million. However, they had no children. They just wanted to leave their money to a charity. And what I said to them was, you know what we're going to do? We're going to set up a simple will. Yes, it's going to go through probate. And yes, it's going to cost the charity a little bit of money. But my goal is to save your family money. And in doing so, yes, a simple will is going to save your family some money. There will be some probate costs after you pass away. But because it's a charitable beneficiary, I think the simplest and easiest and best thing to do for the client is just to have a simple will-based plan. Now, on the other hand, if I meet a young couple with two children and their net worth is just about maybe $100,000 and maybe they own a home as well, then I would tell that family to set up a revocable trust, because if you have real estate that is going to need to go through probate when you pass away, set up the trust and save your children the probate cost. Now, if it's a charity, let the charity pay for the probate. If it's your own children, I would say go ahead and set up a trust, and that will allow you to avoid needing to go to probate, and it will also give it protection over your inheritance. You don't want young children receiving an outright inheritance. So the determination of whether you should have a will or a trust is something that your estate planning attorney can help you with. But generally, I will recommend a trust if a individual has real estate, and very likely if they have children as well.
Right. Blake, let's take our last three and a half minutes here and just kind of walk us through the process. Someone hears us today and they say, you know what, I'm guilty of those mistakes of putting it off and all and not updating, whatever the case may be. Kind of walk us through the process. When they call 833-ASK-BLAKE, your team answers the phone. Kind of walk us through the process.
Well, the good news is you don't need to feel guilty about anything. I've even shared before that I was practicing as an estate planning attorney for a couple years before I even created my own estate plan for my own family. It's like the plumber that goes around and fixes everyone else's toilet and doesn't fix their own leaky toilet. But I got it done about 3 years into my career, and then I had ample peace of mind going forward that I had set up the proper structure for myself and my family, and it allowed me to sleep better at night. So if you are ready to get your estate plan in order, simply give us a call, 833-ASK-BLAKE, or you can just send me an email, blake@blakeharrislaw.com. We'll get you scheduled for a call in the next few days. And then during that call, I'm going to ask about your family situation, your assets, and your goals for your estate plan. Once I have this information, I will be able to give my recommendation for how to design your estate plan, what documents should be included, and how the property is going to be distributed to the beneficiaries. I'll then give you a flat fee quote for the creation of your estate plan so you know exactly what you're getting into from the beginning. Then you'll receive an online intake form. It's a very simple intake form. It takes only about 15 minutes to complete. Once we have the information that we need in order to complete your estate plan, approximately 3 weeks later, we'll send you the documents to review. You can take as long as you'd like to review the documents. You can ask as many questions, make as many revisions as you'd like during the drafting process. Once you are 100% satisfied with your estate plan, we'll have you execute the documents. You can execute the documents on your own from the convenience of your own home by hiring your own notary, or if you'd like, you can come into our office and we'll notarize the documents at no charge. Again, free parking for you downtown next to Union Station. We've got beautiful office space and friendly, helpful staff as well. Once the documents are executed, you have another 30 days to make any changes at no additional charge. If more than 30 days go by, we do charge a nominal fee of a few hundred dollars for any amendments or changes to the estate plan. However, we give free lifetime reviews on every estate plan. So if you've created an estate plan with us 6 months ago or 10 years ago, you can always call our office, and we're always happy to discuss your estate plan with you and give our guidance as to whether any updates or changes need to be made to your estate plan or to any beneficiary designations or transfer on death designations for your estate plan. And that's pretty much the estate planning process.
All right. Well, again, it's Attorney Blake Harris, BlakeHarrisLaw.com. Once again, go on, check out the website. A lot of valuable information right there, as well as the review. So just take a few minutes, and you'll see why we are very proud to have Blake as our estate planning attorney here for Haystack Help Radio and even our Sportsman of Colorado show here on KLZ 560. The phone number is 833-ASK-BLAKE. They are standing by, folks, to help you right now. Not put this off any further. Take care of your family. One of the best things you could do for your family this year is absolutely getting this estate planning matter in order. So, Blake, as always, thank you for your time. Our time always goes too quickly, but we'll look forward to our visit next week.
God, pleasure being on the show. Looking forward to chatting with you soon. Have a great one.
All right, you as well. That's Attorney Blake Harris. Once again, 833-ASK-BLAKE. Give him a call today. Thank you for being with us today for Protect Your Legacy.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.